Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Boy, the Texas Rangers took on Seattle last night. Eric Nadel on KRLD as the Rangers get a walk-off in Arlington.
The pitch is on the way. Odor swings. It's a high drive to deep center field. Martinez going back. He's at the wall. He leaps. That ball is history. A 2-1 walk-off for Rudy. The Rangers have won it 8-7.
Great win for the Rangers as they work down the stretch. They're going to be able to expand rosters to 40 tomorrow. One of the more ridiculous rules in all of sports. I mean, who else expands their roster in the stretch drive except baseball? Suddenly now you can add extra arms, extra pinch runners, maybe a pinch hitter that weren't available the first 5 months of the year. But it's the way it's always been. That's fine. But the rosters expand tomorrow. And I don't know, we don't know yet who claimed Yasiel Puig off waivers. We don't know that. All right, Neil Coulon. The roster cut down was to 75. We're going to have Matt Leon on the Eagles' perspective tomorrow about the roster cut down to 75, including the cut of Reuben Randall. Let's bring in Neil Coulon, talk about the Steelers for a moment. Hi, Neil. Welcome back. Great to have you with us.
As usual, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right, Neil. Let's start with this. Any surprise to get the 75 at all, even a mild one, do you?
No, not at all. That cut is usually is riddled with the PUP listings like we saw across the NFL, Adarius Green kind of being the big name there, but I don't think anybody following the Steelers expected Green to come off and be able to play anytime soon with everything that's gone on regarding him. But other than that, four fairly nondescript players, practice squad, or I should say training camp bodies. Outside of camp, you probably don't need them all that much. And, that's pretty much it.
To go from 75 to 53, which players are in that gray area to you?
It's tough, especially looking at the linebackers. You really like what you've seen of Tyler Matakevich, which is interesting because the Steelers just giving Vince Williams a three-year extension. Vince Williams was very much like Matakevich when he was a rookie back in 2013, in the sense that he's doing well. You're not really quite sure if he's going to make it or not. And oddly enough, Williams was their starter in week two that year because of the injury to Larry Foote. And since then, obviously, Williams has done well with the team, being one of their more physical players and a guy that's probably projected to start next year. Is Matakevich going to be the same kind of player? I don't know. He really has exceeded my expectations to this point. Obviously, a very smart player and a very productive one throughout his four-year career at Temple. I didn't expect him to really be able to duplicate that level of production in the preseason. And granted, he's going up against third and fourth string guys, but that's all he can do at this point. And he's been kind of the standout. So I think if anybody, it'll be very interesting to see if they can find a spot for him. If not, I wouldn't necessarily be surprised to see him get picked up somewhere else. But if he shows any type of special teams ability or has he to this point, I think he's going to make the roster.
Is there any position on the football team where the Steelers might be tempted to look at the wire?
I think offensive tackle would be a primary look right now. Losing Gerald Hawkins for the season, I don't think he was a player they wanted to play this season. I think they wanted to keep him on their active roster and just kind of hope with the depth that they have there among their core players, they wouldn't have to rely on him. But now without that, you kind of have to wonder, do they really want to go in to the season with a guy like, I'm assuming, backup guard Chris Hubbard will make the team. But do you want him being your fourth tackle? Do you want one injury away from him, possibly being pushed into action? From what I saw of him at the tackle position, I probably wouldn't. So I would expect they'll kind of sniff around depends on who it is, of course, and it depends on when it is. I mean, the last couple of years, they've signed, kind of a reserve tackle. Going back to a guy, Whimper, and last year they had Byron Stingley that they picked up during the season. I wouldn't be surprised to see them add a fairly nondescript name like that to serve as that fourth tackle, just in case an emergency comes up, you have a guy that knows the offense, at least has been in the meeting room. But other than that, certainly not anybody of a big name, I wouldn't think. But I'm almost certain they'll come out of this with a tackle from somewhere.
What is the Mike Tomlin approach for the fourth preseason game?
Get everybody out of the stadium healthy. I don't think you're going to see really anybody of particular note playing in this game. I think you'll see, once again, Landry Jones playing a good amount of it. From there, Bryce Renner, I think you'll see him playing quite a bit. Probably he'll get the second half. But I don't think many teams have a whole lot of questions at this point. With their roster, there might be a battle here and there, but top to bottom, I think they have a pretty good idea of who their team is, and I think they're to some degree preparing for Washington on September 11th. So, with this, I think they're really just going to try to find guys that that can put up the semblance of a game, which we all know the fourth preseason game is easily the worst of a very bad crop of games, and this is the one that they have the least amount of emphasis on.
Landry Jones has always been nondescript to poor in the preseason. Then when he got into games last year when they counted, he hung in there. When you watch him now in the preseason where he's getting a lot of reps, where is he better and where is this game just too overwhelming for him or he'll never get better?
I think the things that we saw from Jones last year in particular, not going all the way back to his second and first season late, but last year, what I was disappointed with him was about the lack of quickness in his decisions. He really just took too long to find a receiver to make a decision and commit to it. And still, even with that, he'd throw interceptions. He'd turn the ball over. The clock in his head, to use a cliche, which I probably shouldn't be as a non-professional quarterback, the clock in his head just doesn't seem wired with others who would be even backups in the NFL. It just seems like pressure gets to him much sooner than he's able to react to it. He doesn't keep his eyes down the field when that happens, and he can't make throws in duress. And the majority of the interceptions we've seen him throw in the preseason as well as the regular season have been in pressure situations where he's failed to deliver a catchable ball. The three interceptions we saw against Kansas City and the start that he had last year, those weren't good. Those weren't competitive mistakes. It wasn't him necessarily trying to make a play. He felt pressure, and he delivered a poor pass. And I think we've seen that to a degree this preseason as well. So I'm not sure how much exactly he's improved, but I'll give this to him. I thought he did a great job against the Saints. That was by far and away the best that he's looked throughout his preseason career. And granted, to be honest with you, from what I saw, I'm not sure the Saints are out of the top 10 of drafting this year. Really just a team that doesn't look in sync at all. And Jones exploited that, but hey, that's what he's supposed to do. And in that, he hit a deep pass to Sammy Coates, an excellent pressure throw. Put it out where Coates was going to be able to make a play on it, and he took a pretty good shot in doing it. So I think with him, he sticks on the team, but obviously things have gone horribly wrong if you have to enter a game this year.
This has become very much a sub-package league. So let's start defensively. When they go sub-package on defense, give me the couple of guys there that look to you, Neil, like they're real contributors, especially when they're in a sub-package that can make a difference.
I really like Javon Hargrave in that kind of a role. And sub-package, I think, might be used kind of loosely when it comes to those defensive linemen. I mean, they're probably their base alignment is the sub-package now out of their nickel, but it's more of that 2-4-5 look that they'll give. They do have packages in which they have three-down linemen, and he's rushing from like a 4-eye technique. And in that, we've seen him get off the ball very, very quickly. That was one thing that really stood out in his college film. And with that, you always want to take into account the level of competition he's going up against. But this kid really might just be that quick of an athlete from a down stance. And he's getting into the backfield. He's displaying a lot of strength. If you remember the play in the New Orleans game that Stephon Tuitt forced an intentional grounding penalty, Hargrave blew the center probably 3 yards off the ball. That's what forced the quarterback to the outside, and he did it right at the snap. So I think he's going to be an impact player in those sub packages. I think there are going to be situations where they can get him in probably a pure rush situation and just let him go. In doing that, I think they might have themselves a good little playmaker this season.
Speaking of playmakers, is there a playmaker in the offensive sub package that bears watching that could be a subtle difference for them as they move forward?
I think there are two parts to that. I think immediately you think of a guy like Marcus Wheaton.
Right.
But this really all kind of depends on what you define as a sub package. I think they use all of their receivers, the ones behind Antonio Brown, of course, in a variety of different ways. I don't think Wheaton necessarily is their starter. I think Darius Hayward Bay is going to be the guy on the outside, but I don't think that Wheaton is going to get considerably fewer snaps than Hayward Bay will. I think both of them will have big plays because of their specific abilities. Wheaton is an incredible athlete, very quick inside the hashes. Putting him on the outside creates a lot of mismatch opportunities when you're dragging him across the middle. How exactly are you going to be able to defend that? Hayward Bay is a very big guy and is still very, very fast. Ben likes to throw him the ball deep. That stretches out your defense. He's going to make a play or two from that. Even if he catches half of his targets, which is kind of, standard for him, he's going to make a couple big plays. He's going to have a 15-yard average. So I would consider them to be sub-package kinds of guys in the sense that they're not going to get a ton of targets, but they can make some plays. And at the same time, and I've been on your show kind of bashing this pick in the past, I'll take my I can't even think of the word, but rip on me as much of this as you want. But I thought Jesse James looked very well for what they've asked him to do to this point. And oddly enough, he's the guy who's going to end up replacing Heath Miller. He's not going to be that level of player, as Roethlisberger has said many, many times. But I was very impressed with his level of focus and concentration. Particularly against the Saints. He got a lot of catches on broken down plays, stuff where the primary read wasn't there. He stuck right with Ben. He was exactly where he was supposed to be. And he caught short passes and really just kind of took what the defense gave him. So I don't think James is going to be a heavy target, but if you have a team that really is aggressive with their front seven, he's shown a lot of ability to find himself open in that 6 to 7 yard range.
In 2011, Neil, the Steelers as a team voted against the collective bargaining agreement that was passed. They voted as a team. Everybody voted against it. Did the James Harrison situation in the past couple of weeks resurrect some of those feelings?
I think you have there's a lot of turnover. There are very few players that were in that locker room back then, but many of them, in particular Ramon Foster, who's now the Steelers union representative, pointed back to it and said very simply, look, these were some of the issues that we had with this. And it wasn't just that. I think that's been glorified a little bit too much in the media. The Steelers had other issues, but really their big beef was they didn't have any time to review it, to their opinion, but they had problems with giving the commissioner that much power. And Foster went out of his way. I thought he delivered a very powerful message and a well-timed one after all of this, saying, start saving your money, guys, because we're going to have to fight to get this back in the next collective bargaining agreement in 2021, I believe, is the last year of this one.
Yes,
so he's cautioning that the future generation of the NFL to say, if you guys want this to stop, we need to actually sit down and make this a priority. We didn't do that last time, and Foster kind of insinuated it was because we didn't have cash saved up. So save your money, and let's see if we can get this done this time. So in that regard, yeah, I think it is something that the Steelers remembered, and I think it is very incumbent upon Foster, considering his position, to advise the current and soon-to-be future of the NFL to prepare for this. It's not something they're going to want to continue. For everything we've seen over the last couple of years within the commissioner's office, they're going to need to be able to do something about it. The only way is going to be to kind of take a seat and try to figure this out.
I found it interesting that 2 weeks ago was the exact 10th anniversary of Roger Goodell's ascension to commissioner of the NFL. There was no press conference, no training camp tour, anything like that. It quietly came and went. One final question, then I'll let you go. When you first heard about what happened with Teddy Bridgewater, just what ran through your mind?
Just horrible. Absolutely horrible. It's shocking, to hear something like that in a non-contact situation. That the grisly nature of it was just a freakish play for a talented young kid, and you hate to see it. You can't really put a specific diagnosis on, anticipated recovery date or regimen or anything he's going to have to go through. But your only thought is there are guys that had stuff that's similar to this that never played again, or at least they tried and they weren't half the player that they were before. It's a shame. You know, I really like what Bridgewater has done to this point in his career. I really like the direction Mike Zimmer has the Vikings going, and it's tough. You really just you hope for the best for him, and you hope nobody else has to go through that.
Well said. Neil, thanks so much. Always a pleasure. Thanks for your time.
Definitely. Thanks for having me.
Meanwhile, the NFL has officially cleared James Harrison, Clay Matthews, Julius Peppers, and the Al Jazeera PED investigation. Mike Neal has not been cleared yet, only because he's not playing right now. But they still have to interview him. But, you know, so far, these are the names cleared. James Harrison, Peyton Manning, Clay Matthews, Julius Peppers, and in baseball, Ryan Howard and Ryan Zimmerman. That was some report, huh? Okay, we'll come back with more in a moment. Otto Bolton, next half hour on News Radio 1070 WKOK. All right, plenty of baseball this afternoon. Let's get to the board here. Detroit beat the White Sox 3-2. Top of the second at AT&T, where the Giants lead Arizona 2-0. Top of the fifth at Coors, where Colorado leads the Dodgers 2-0. Minute Maid Park, top of the eighth inning. Oakland leads at Houston 3-1. Bottom of the seventh, Texas all over Seattle 8-0. And the Red Sox, Hanley Ramirez hit a grand slam. Jackie Bradley Jr. is homered, and the Red Sox lead Tampa Bay 6-4 in the top of the eighth inning. Tozawa's in, and of course, the bases are loaded. All right, so you looked out at that bullpen. I'm telling you right now, there's a single Red Sox fan that hasn't increased their use of religion all summer long in the bullpen. Hey, let's go to the bullpen. Oh, please. What are we doing? And the Phillies play Washington tonight, 6:30 the airtime, here on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Phillies and the Nationals coming up tonight at beautiful Citizens Bank Park. Gio Gonzalez is going to go for the Nationals tonight. Morgan will get the ball tonight for the Phils. And I know that Morgan's had a tough time this year, very tough time. You know what? They've hung in there. I think, you know, when it's all said and done, the Phillies might win 75 games this year. That's not bad, considering everything for the season. They've got what? How many wins they have now? 60? They could win 15 games in September. Get to 75. Respectable. Now, I was laughing. Kirk Herbstreit says that. Who's on upset alert? He's got Georgia. See what we got here. He had upset alert. One of them, I think, was Georgia. And I'm sitting there like, Georgia? On upset alert? They're playing at North Carolina. North Carolina's ranked 22nd in the nation. I mean, what kind of upset's that? It's not an upset. What, just because there's a number next to it? No. Put a little bit too much on rankings. We're like, rankings. You know, so one team must be better than the other. One's 18, the other one's 19. A number. Nobody knows. North Carolina's pretty good. Remember, North Carolina gave Clemson all it could handle in the ACC championship game, and they have almost everybody back. By the way, former Nittany Lion Bill Lankitis passed away. Part of that 1967 Lambert Trophy team that went 8-2-1 for Joe Paterno. Played 14 seasons in the NFL, a good chunk of it with the San Diego Chargers and a good chunk of it with the New England Patriots. Ended up living at Foxborough, and I believe he was the Patriots team dentist. Great guy, but Ben Lankitis passing away today. Or excuse me, he didn't pass away today, he passed away. Trying to think, I want to say it was Sunday. Saturday or Sunday. That's when I first heard about it. But he played for Rip Engel for 2 years, or one season. He played for 2 years for Joe. Wife Donna, they were married for 44 years. Otto Bolden coming up in the next half hour. That'll be fun. We're looking forward to that on News Radio 1070 WKOK in the Sunbury Motors studio. Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Key Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors studio, here's Steve Jones.
Great to be with you on this Wednesday. Plenty coming up tomorrow on the show and also on Friday. Of course, a lot of Penn State football talk with the opener coming up on Saturday. We'll have that for you. Looking forward to that. All right. Matt Leon on the Eagles tomorrow, too, by the way. Let's get to our guests. And we're thrilled to have him because there were many stars in Rio that were competing, and there were certain stars that stood out as broadcasters. This was one of the stars that stood out as a broadcaster, Otto Bolden, four-time Olympic medalist himself. Otto, welcome. It is a pleasure to have you with us on the show.
Thank you, Steve. Good to be with you.
All right, so let's get to it. Obviously, a lot of people want to talk about Usain Bolt. You've seen all nine of his gold medals. What has been the separator, not just physically, but mentally, that has allowed him to sustain excellence over a long period of time?
Yeah, that's a good point. A lot of what he's doing, obviously he's physically gifted, but if you look at his body language, look at the body language of people running against him, he has won most of those races before the gun, long before the gun sounds. One, a lot of people know, okay, well, this is a guy capable of running 9.6. That's something I've never done, or 9.5. That's something I've never done. But he comes to each race with such an air of nonchalance that I think people look at it and they go, this guy's not concerned about me. So I think that's some of his real genius, how he's able to show up at the line when all eyes are on him, with the sort of air of, you know, what me worry.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you won four medals yourself. You won two in Atlanta, two in Sydney. So that four-year separator. He's done this over 8, 12, and 16, where a variety of things can happen to you. What does it take to keep yourself at a peak when you have a separation of 4 years before you go out and do something like that again?
It takes a lot of belief, first of all. It's not that long ago, 2012, when Usain Bolt lost at his trials in both the 100 and the 200. And there were a lot of people at the time who were saying, okay, so Bolt has had a good run. He wowed us in 2008 with those fantastic world records. But now he has to exit stage right because Johan Blake, who is younger and hungrier, et cetera, is now going to assume the mantle, and, you know, we'll see how close Bolt can get in the Olympics in 2012. And he came to the Olympics in London and crushed everybody again. And that says to me that this is somebody who has supreme belief in his abilities, because we're not talking about the rest of the world saying he was done. People in Jamaica were saying, okay, so Bolt has sort of, you know, partied and hung out, and here's a young lion who's basically come up and bit him in the neck. So the fact that he has been able to do that through injury, through doubt, through all the things that happen to the guy who's walking around with the title of the world's fastest man, it says a lot about what he's been able to overcome. His team has been supreme in terms of getting him ready, keeping him confident, almost like the heavyweight champion of the world. Where, yeah, it's not going to always be great in training. You're not always going to have life things that don't get in the way. But somehow when that bell sounds, he's always answered the bell.
And that's been amazing. Now, what has it been about the United States in the relay where they've struggled over the years with the baton part of it? you watch, the exchange is important. What has kept them from succeeding and being the dominant relay team at times that they were in past Olympiads?
Yeah, and we should probably preface this conversation by saying that the last two times the United States women have been in the Olympic Games, they have run the world record in 2012, the second fastest time ever in 2016, and won the gold both times. The men have not won a world or Olympic title since 2007. World titles since 2007 have not won the Olympic title since 2000. To answer your question, wow, I wish I knew. Because it seems like every year it's something new. If I had to give you my analysis of it, I think you have to almost scrap the core of the people that you have, because they keep putting the same, I'd say, two or three or four guys. And no, it's not that one particular person every time, but it always seems like if you look at the composition of the U.S. team over the last 5 to 6 years. It's the same guys. I prefer to lose a couple of times and get to stick around with new guys who are getting better than with guys who have always been there but seem to constantly make a mistake. Relay running requires some improv. And as soon as things go badly, that men's team has not been able to recover properly. The Jamaicans have been flawless since 2008. It's not because they're necessarily that much better. It's because that when things go wrong over the course of the race, they somehow have found a way to recover and not make it a fatal mistake. So it's unfortunate, and quite frankly, it's mind-blowing that a team with that much depth has not been able to successfully, you know, get the job done in so long.
The women, as you mentioned, have the right formula of speed and coordination on this, and you talk about the United States may, look, let's start over again. Is it just a certain personality type it takes to run this in combination with the speed, Otto?
Yeah, you want somebody who is going to, quite frankly, I want a smart sprinter on my relay, and it's one of the reasons why you see Allison Felix. Allison Felix has been on the last two United States gold medal winning teams, and she's been on quite a few of their world championship teams. Now, there are people from the outside who look and they may say, hey, Allison Felix didn't run the 100-meter dash at the Olympic trials. In fact, she didn't even make the team in the 200, so how come she's on the 4x1? Isn't the United States just blessed with all these sprinters? Absolutely. But how many of them have the experience that she has? How many of them are as smart as she is with the baton in her hand? And that's why you see Allison Felix on those teams. And I think that they have not done that with the men. With the men, they have said, okay, well, this one got first, and this one got second, and this one got third, and this one got fourth. And let's take fifth and sixth, and that's going to be our core. And to me, because you're the United States and you have all this depth, what you should say is, who are the four or five best handlers of the baton that we have? Let's start there, and then we'll deal with the politics of, okay, well, the guy who won the trials has to go and all that other stuff, because to me they've just continued to put guys in a position to fail. And it's like, how many more attempts do you need? I don't think anybody in the United States would complain if you said, you know what, you've already had three mistakes or three screw-ups, and you'll never see a U.S. relay again. I don't think anybody would have a complaint about that. The United States is all about second chances. I don't know about third and fourth chances.
Right. Well, Allison Felix, of course, had a great career. She's going to turn 31 in November, for goodness sakes, and she's ended up winning 9 medals in her career. What kind of standard has she set to then set the tone for future Olympians that can then try to duplicate that?
Allison has had a remarkable career, and more importantly, she's paid her dues. Her first two Olympic Games did not go her way, in that she was trying to win the gold in 2004 and got silver in the 200, and she was trying to win the gold 4 years later in Beijing and got silver. A lot of those medals have come in the 4x1 and have come in the 4x4, but I think what her real legacy is not being afraid to step out of your comfort zone. She has always stated that she hates the 400-meter dash, and yet you look up and you go, wow, she has two world championships. She has a world championship silver. She has an Olympic silver. And she has a world championship. She has an Olympic silver and a world championship gold in that event. Allison is one of the very few Americans that has run in the Olympic Games for the United States in the 100, the 200, and the 400. I believe it's only one other person that's done it. So Allison has left a remarkable legacy, not just on the track, because she, obviously she's known for all those medals, but what she has done with the First Lady's Council for fitness and so on, with kids, and a lot of the things that she, that maybe don't make huge headlines, I think is part of her amazing history. She's going to be, you know, she's a one-of-a-kind talent, but she's also been a one-of-a-kind off the track as well.
Otto, Michael Johnson's record in the 400 stood for 17 years. That's a remarkable standard. But then you witnessed, along with Tom Hammonds, Wade Van Niekerk of South Africa, breaking that record. Discuss the run and what the moment felt like in the stadium to see such a long-standing record go by the boards.
Well, that to me, and according to most of the polls that have come out since the Rio Olympic track and field program, is the performance of the track and field program in the Olympic Games. In terms of TV, we couldn't have done it better, because we could have done something on Karani James, who was the defending champion. We could have done something on LaShawn Merritt, who had won the Olympic title in the 400 in 2008. We chose to go with a very strong feature on Wade Van Niekerk, and, you know, most people saw his coach, who is a grandmother, and his mother, who could not compete, even though she was a great athlete because of the apartheid era. And I thought we set it up perfectly in that, you know, nobody had ever won the Olympic Games from lane eight. There's been people who've won it from the outside lane back when it was six lanes, but never from lane eight. I had actually been sort of teasing that race as the race to watch. And Al Michaels came over and we did a segment, and I said, you know, it's going to take closer to 43 flat than 44 flat to win that event. And people on social media would light me up. Oh, stop with your usual exaggeration. It's not going to, that world record is safe, blah, 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 blah. And then the gun goes off. He can't see his two main rivals behind him, and he just never comes back to them. 43.03. It was an amazing race. The high point for me of the entire games in terms of performance. It reminded me of David Rudisha's 800-meter world record 4 years ago in 2012. But what that kid means to that country and to that country's sporting legacy is amazing. So it was good to see a young, humble kid come to the Olympic Games and have that sort of story for all parties concerned. An amazing, amazing performance.
It's a real plus to have you on there, because you bring the sport to life for people and you bring it to them in a way that they can understand. Otto, thank you so much for the time you gave us today, for your perspective there and for your perspective today. It's greatly appreciated.
Oh, I appreciate it greatly. Thank you very much.
The outstanding Otto Bolton. Wow. Great to have him on. What a job he did for NBC and for everybody across the board. All right, we're going to take a break. We are going to come back, wrap it up in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK. When it comes to car buying, there's the other guy's way, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Subaru Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC way. The choice is up to you. The other guy's way or the SMC way? The SMC way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years. Welcome back in the final segment. Of course, the big quarterback news about Teddy Bridgewater yesterday that Scott Hansen talked about on the show. Dislocated knee and torn ACL, other damage as well. So obviously he's out for the year. The Vikings now have to shop for a quarterback in all of this, and it's not exactly the part that they needed to get to. because they felt they had a chance to surpass Green Bay in the division permanently, and they're not going to be able to do it unless they have somebody that can play that spot. The running game is so important, no question. Jack Ham and I talk about it in the college level all the time. I know that the football has become far more of a pass-happy game at this stage, but you still need to have a really good running game to succeed, at least enough of one to succeed. You know, the Patriots have kind of belied that theory for a while with Tom Brady at quarterback and really a multitude of running backs that they've gone through over the years. Lawrence Maroney, Corey Dillon, guys like that. You look at the guys they won the Super Bowl with. Their better teams, though, have been with, for example, when they had Corey Dillon, that's one of their better teams, the one that beat the Eagles. When they had Lawrence Maroney and he was at his peak, young but still at his peak, that was obviously one of their better teams. So if you have a really good running game, it can make a big difference in everything you do. Steelers are exponentially effective because they have Le'Veon Bell and they know the importance of it. So then when they knew Bell was going to be out early last year, they picked up D'Angelo Williams and he made a big difference last year. But you still need the guy to throw the ball. You can't just have a running game in the NFL. So you've got Adrian Peterson, but if you don't have the trigger man at quarterback to make it work, then you're going to have some problems that you're going to have to deal with. And that's where the Vikings are right now. And it's really going to test Mike Zimmer as a coach without question. So where do they go? And that's a big question. Part of it's going to be how some people perform in their games coming up. I mean, is Colin Kaepernick, for example, is he a possibility to go up there? Would they want to take on that contract? I mean, look at the Denver Broncos. Trevor Siemian, starting quarterback. Okay. Now, I thought Trevor Siemian was a good prospect when he was at Northwestern. I always liked Trevor Siemian. Jack and I talked about how strong his arm was and so forth. But, I mean, in the NFL, as a starter now, I thought maybe he'd have a crack maybe in his fourth or fifth year, but not now. So this is what the Vikings will have to do. I don't know, you know, which way they have to find somebody. They can't go with who they have on the roster right now. The person on the roster right now does have, obviously, complete knowledge of the offense. But they have to do something. They have to do something. And it's going to be interesting to see what direction that they go in. It's interesting when you look at the stories. Okay, here's the stories. Teddy Bridgewater, obvious. That's a big time. Then several U.S. Open stories. Okay. But then there's four different stories here on Tim Tebow. Okay, going to baseball. Another Yasiel Puig claimed off of waivers. It's amazing how ESPN, for example, gets really attached to a name because they think the name moves the needle. All right, now I can understand that. You know, they think the name moves the needle. But they've got a problem right now with moving the needle. That's a big problem for them, moving the needle. A lot of people were not happy. And Joel Klatt of Fox Sports, very rare when you have one announcer at one network criticize another network, but he did. And he was disgusted with the coverage of Cal Hawaii in the opening game on Friday night. For one thing, the two announcers, Mike Beswick, who was on our show in April before the Indianapolis 500, and Mike Bellotti did the game in Bristol, Connecticut. They did not do the game in Sydney. I know you spend a lot of money on rights fees. I think there are other areas you can cut back in terms of how you approach something. I mean, do you really need announcers on site for the X Games, for example? You have to look at what your franchises are, and I think you got to take care of your franchises and do it in a first-class way because people can tell. I mean, I kept watching that game on Friday night. And, you know, because I wanted to watch the opening college game of the year. And to be honest with you, Hawaii and Cal, especially in the first half of the game, really an entertaining game. Kept going back and forth, each team scoring. But evidently there was a lot of juice in the crowd. It was great, but it didn't come through the TV screen. And you could tell that they were detached from what they were watching as well. They did more talking about the SEC season coming up, the college football playoff, and not enough locking in on the two teams. And I think there's been so much talk about the big picture in games right now that they're getting away from the game that they have in front of them at that moment. And that's the part that, you know, is disturbing. I know that they're spending a lot of money. I realize that. I mean, when the Big Ten comes out with its contract, it's going to be $240 million per year from Fox. It's going to be $190 million per year from ESPN. It's going to be, then for basketball, $10 million a year from CBS. And then there's the Big Ten Network, which obviously brings in its huge chunk of change, probably to the tune of between $110 to $140 million per year that they split up. But you have to be able to take what your franchises are, and I think college football is a franchise for ESPN, and you have to throw whatever you have into it. Penn State basketball, for example, last year, and I know it's Penn State basketball, which is getting better, but three games in the final month of the season were done from Charlotte, North Carolina. We had Adam Amin on the show, 2 weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago. And remember, I asked him about broadcasting games from the studio and the difficulty of it. And you could tell, look, he's a really great company man who has an incredibly bright future. But you could also sense there's a little frustration doing, look, I'm doing what they're telling me to do, and I'm going to do it to the best of my ability, which he does. But you want to be on site for these games. And I think the fan, even though, oh, at least we've got the picture, you can't just have that attitude about it. We at least have the picture. People want people on site, want to feel like the game has singular importance because you, the viewer, took the time to watch it. All right. Big day coming up tomorrow, our high school football roundtable. Looking forward to that. Thanks to Otto Bolton. As we continue on News Radio 1070, WKOK.